Welcome to the Prenda Podcast. I'm Kelly Smith, and I'm looking for the best new ideas in education. I'll be talking to all sorts of people about new types of schools, reinventing education, and helping kids love learning. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Okay, welcome back to the Prenda Podcast. Today is October 3rd. I'm sitting here with Angelica Cruz, who has opened the System Charter School in Phoenix. It's a STEM-based 6th through 12th grade, really cool school. If you ever get a chance, I'm probably like advertising for tours.
Yes, please.
But you got to meet Angelica and see what they're doing here. Lots of the tech community from the Phoenix and broader area is part of the school in some way, shape, or form. Some big heavy hitters from the angel investment community are on the board and passionately advocating. In fact, I just got hit up to come help with clubs here. As many people in the tech community, I'm sure, have heard about System. So this is our chance to kind of talk about this. And I'm really grateful to Angelica. Hi, Angelica.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Of course.
To talk about this. So we're going to go through the whole process of creating a charter school and what that's like and running it. Angelica is super passionate about kids and learning. But the main thing that I want to focus on, and this is, you'll hear core to the school here. Today, our question of the day is, how can projects help somebody learn? So I want to really understand, the role of building a project, doing a project, working through the creative process, doing all of that in really learning and mastering concepts and just making it real and also hopefully making it fun and engaging. I've walked around and looked through the glass walls here at the school, and it looks pretty fun and
definitely
engaging to me.
Definitely.
So let's get started. So Angelica, talk to me a little bit about your kind of education background. You can go back as far
sure.
as you want and your story. And along the way, we'll get into how projects work here at System and just in your philosophy.
Sure. As you said, take you back to my own history. It made me immediately get a memory of when I was in middle school, because that's our school's middle and high school.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when I was in middle school, I actually didn't go to school for a STEM career. That wasn't my interest or strength as a student at all. But my dad was really involved with NASA, and he took me to my first nanotechnology conference when I was in seventh grade.
What?
And it was before like anybody knew what nanotechnology was.
Yeah.
And I was first of all the only female in the entire room.
Right.
And it was probably a group of like 40 engineers and people in the field of nanotechnology. So it was down at Stanford.
Wait, so this wasn't for seventh graders?
No, it was not for seventh graders. No, it was for business people.
You were like
sneaking in. My dad took me and it was like, oh, I'm bringing my daughter to this conference.
And when you say he was really involved with NASA,
I don't even know. He was like on the board of some advisory thing with NASA. I just kind of, I was in seventh grade. I didn't really pay attention to it. But he was like, hey, you want to come to this conference with me? It's down in Stanford. And as a seventh grader, I was like, they have a really good mall there. Sure. So I went along and I was there and, just totally blown away by the quality of the work and the scientists that were in the room. And it was sort of at that moment that was the turning point for me as a student where I realized this is the future and this is where the world is headed and nobody else is even aware this is happening.
Right.
In terms of
it's like you're
the
part
US.
Of this secret club.
Yeah.
Of people who
exactly.
know what's going on.
Exactly. So that was sort of planting the seed, I think, for STEM education for me.
Awesome.
So I went on to, high school and college, didn't graduate with a STEM degree, but kind of always had this in the back of my mind of, oh my gosh, the country is really behind and we need to get on top of this. Really soon, some way or another.
And just in case, Angelica, if somebody doesn't know what STEM is.
Oh, science, technology, engineering, and math.
I know I use the acronym.
Sure,
it's very
I use
popular.
It all the time, yeah. Yeah, no, good to break those down. So went on to college, was supposed to go to law school at Columbia, actually, and wasn't really 100% sure that's what I wanted to do. Saw a poster for Teach for America one day in our student union over at Tufts, and I thought, gosh, maybe I'll just go teach for a couple years
right.
and see what's wrong, in the educational system.
So
and
you had thought about education, but not studied education.
Yeah, definitely didn't study education. Studied community health and child development, so somewhat connected. But really thought I wanted to go into like children's advocacy work and legal support. So anyway, joined Teach for America, filled out my application in January when I was in Boston. I literally picked the warmest place on the map,
beautiful
and that's how
town.
I ended up in Phoenix.
Yeah.
So I came here. No, had never been here before.
So you're from California?
No, Oregon. Originally Oregon. Yep. Went to college in Boston and then came out here because it was warm.
So skip New York.
So skip New York. Go to Phoenix. Yeah. And then I got involved in education here and pretty quickly realized that our educational system was really broken. And that's when it started to come full circle of my passion for working with kids and changing our system, and also realizing that STEM education wasn't happening the way it needed to be happening.
Yeah. Okay. We'll stop for a minute because it's fascinating that you did Teach for America. Mm-hmm. Our last guest on this podcast was Andrew Collins.
Oh, awesome.
I'm sure you know.
I know Andrew well.
And did Teach for America. And so that seems to be this like running theme of these like bright young people doing.
Yep.
So tell me about your experience and like what you saw, because you say broken, and I know I talk to parents all the time that will say the same thing, right?
Sure.
Like, education's broken. But then when you push on it, it's like often they have different interpretations of
what
that
means.
So what did you see and experience,
absolutely,
you know, that really made you think, I've got to put my effort behind this?
Well, for example, I taught in on the west side of Phoenix, and I taught kindergarten in a 100% free and reduced lunch school.
Okay.
It was considered an underperforming school. They had a big reading grant, and so my favorite thing about, or least favorite thing about the school, the kids were amazing, the teachers were amazing, but the priorities of the administration and the district were really bizarre because it all followed the money. And so they had a big reading grant, and so all anybody cared about was teaching reading. And we literally had a scripted curriculum we had to carry around with us, and if anybody ever walked in our room and we didn't have the scripted curriculum on us, it was like an evaluation.
It's like a packet,
game.
Like a book?
Like a book. Yeah, it was a big book. It was huge. It was like 8.5 by 15. It was bigger than a piece of paper.
Holy
so this big
God.
Book you had to carry around with you.
And you're like literally dinged if you don't have it.
If you don't have it on you and you're not reading.
Because
from
that
it.
Was a requirement of the grant?
Yes.
I mean, that's basically.
They purchased a scripted curriculum. So again, it's all about purchasing curriculum. That's where education is right now, especially in Arizona. It's you have to buy a research, you know, proven, you know, something that we know works, because basically we don't trust teachers to go out and do it anymore.
So well intentioned.
Well-intentioned.
Okay, the curriculum will.
Yep.
This curriculum
will
always good.
This will fix it. Will be the silver bullet. That was what everybody thought. So I literally had to teach.
Was the word silver bullet actually used?
Oh, by teachers, yeah.
Teachers, like, sarcastically.
Yeah, sarcastically. Yeah. But no, the administration really believed, understandably so, you know, this is what's going to fix our problems.
Or if it doesn't, at least it's justifiable back to the people who give us the money, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you're going to kind of understand the way a system like that would work.
Yeah.
It's like, we got to get this money because our school's
We need the money.
Struggling.
Exactly.
And
here's what we have to do as part of getting
the
money.
Make these promises. Okay.
Exactly.
So you're carrying around this thing. You're like, this is not working. Like you could see it in the kids' eyes.
And we never taught math. I literally had to teach math while I was taking my kids on group bathroom breaks.
What?
I would do flashcards as we walked down the hallway to teach them how to add and subtract.
So all they learned is reading.
All they learned was reading.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, they had maybe 6 hours of instruction a day, and 4.5 had to be reading.
Wow.
So you had an hour and a half for anything else.
So. They at least learned how to
Science
read?
Science didn't happen at all.
Did the reading work?
They did. They learned how to read. They were great readers.
That's
it was
great.
Awesome.
Okay.
But they had no purpose for their reading. You know, there was no passion connected to it.
Got it.
Which sort of is what led me to, there's got to be a better way to do school. We can't just read scripted curriculum and memorize things all day long.
And doesn't it kind of, think about you as the educator in that role. It kind of demeans you a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
You're sort of like, I don't get to be human. I'm just sort of like this robot that's
robot.
Up here.
That's pretty much exactly how teachers felt. And so then you end up with teacher turnover, right? Because teachers don't feel empowered. They don't feel trusted to do what they're doing and to, you know, that they're making good decisions. So they feel like all they have to do is read off a scripted book.
And even the kids then feel it. They're kind of like, all right.
Oh, yeah, it trickles all the way down. Yep.
So it affects the whole culture. Okay.
Exactly.
So this is interesting. So you saw all these problems.
Yes, saw all these problems. And really, quite honestly, the second year I was like, oh, this is so broken. I don't think I can do anything. Because every time I would try to bring something up, I would just get pushback of, oh, well, it's not in the grant. Or, oh, we don't have funding for that. Like, there was just lots of no's, right?
Right.
So I thought, you know what, there's really nothing I can do here. But then I went on what was called an excellent school visit organized by Teach for America. It was basically where they would take teachers, TFA teachers, around to different schools that were performing.
Okay.
So we could see what, you know, initiatives were happening in other schools. So I went to one right down the road here, led by a TFA alum, and it was same community, same free and reduced lunch population, drastically different school.
You just feel different.
Oh, everything felt different. Teachers were working together. There was support. They taught all the subjects. Yeah. You know, things that you would think would be no-brainer. So, you know, math was taught. They did science. You know, they had a really well-run school. And most importantly, I think teachers felt that their voice mattered and that what they were doing was meaningful.
Yeah, and it the wasn't passion
just,
was there.
Yeah, and it wasn't just read the scripted curriculum. So I happened to say, hey, do you have any positions open next year? And he's like, actually, I do.
So your little field trip.
My little field trip all of a sudden turned into, okay, maybe I will stay in education because I could see a path now.
Right.
You know, I saw him and, you know, talked with him about how he helps grow leaders, and I realized this is a new path that I could go on where I could actually make a difference in education.
Amazing. So just
so I'm over there.
And one of my recent, I guess it's actually not produced yet, mm-hmm. but it's going to be released soon. One of our podcasts, it was talking to a homeschool mom about culture.
Mm.
And it's interesting that you saw, you know, everything else the same.
Yeah.
Basically culture being kind of the difference between yep. like people wanting to be there, kids wanting to learn.
Exactly.
Things are working. And yeah. The opposite of that.
Exactly, and the opposite, yep.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's how I ended up over there, and from there it was a pretty clear path into leadership. I mean, he was an amazing principal who was constantly pushing me into, hey, you should be on this committee. Hey, you should, have you thought about this?
Yeah.
Hey, I want to get your feedback on how do we emphasize college more on our campus.
So you were almost lured
I was lured in, yep.
Leading.
Yeah.
And so what was your trajectory?
So I taught kindergarten there for a few more years, and then I taught fifth grade, and then I worked with the ELL students in middle school.
English language learners.
Yep. Yes. More acronyms.
Don't live inside of the educational world.
Yes, English language learners. Specifically, they were called newcomers in the district because they were like brand new to the country.
Straight from
Mexico or Iraq or wherever they came from.
Yeah.
So worked with them and then became an instructional coach specifically focused on student achievement data. So basically what that means is I worked with teachers to look at their assessment data uh-huh. and help them make changes in what they were doing so they would see changes in their data.
I've got this crazy notion, and this is mm-hmm. probably my background in tech, that it's almost, I don't see this for every educator, but there's this like specialty role. Like, if you go to any software company now, there's a data scientist at the company where they, like, they write. I mean, it's pretty insane, uh-huh. even just from a tech perspective. They've got these Mongo databases, and they're writing all these, like, Python that's analyzing it all. But they can come up with these amazing insights mm-hmm. that really help the business, help things operate.
Right.
Do you see? I mean, I kind of have this idea of teacher as data scientist.
Yeah, like. there is definitely a move towards it. I mean, this was an initiative that the whole district took to create these positions. So every school all of a sudden, instead of just having an instructional coach, very valuable, right? You go in, you observe instruction, you give feedback.
Right.
But the data coach was specifically looking at what's your achievement data say and what can we do to help that improve.
Right.
So we worked together. So the instructional coach and the data coach, we worked really close together so that teachers were getting the same messages from both of us and we were supporting each other.
Now I'm thinking about something like Moneyball. I don't know if you saw this. It's like a book or movie about baseball, the sport of baseball, and how analytics and basically data came in and totally revolutionized the game. This is, you know, in the last like 20 years.
Yeah.
And basically now you have the old timer who can like analyze somebody's swing and you know, just the mechanics of the stuff that people have, the art of baseball,
sure,
I guess, that's been their favor, mixed now with the science. It's like you need to like not swing at the first pitch. Like statistically, I can show you that by swinging the first pitch, you're popping out.
Yep.
So there's different, anyway, and I'm not an expert on the analytics of baseball, but I think this idea of math infused with, and I think this is the key, maybe you can talk to this, is there's this danger when you get too obsessed with data, and I'm sure this happens, where you can be only data, right?
Totally.
You leave the art form behind. It's like, we forget that these are humans.
Right. Well, and that's actually a perfect segue into what project-based learning is.
Great.
Because that, I mean, for example, what you just said, the science of baseball, right? There's art and science to it. And so it's taking things like baseball that you don't traditionally think even have anything to do with STEM, and then it's using that to teach students science, technology, engineering, and math. So STEM becomes the vehicle to learn math, science, reading, writing, persuasive text, I mean, any kind of standard, right? Any kind of common core standard that schools have to teach now, you can do it.
Some of our listeners just quit listening because you said common core.
Oh, sorry. No. It's a bad word, isn't it?
But basically, the idea is, we've decided as a society that there's certain things that we would like everyone to know at the end of school. And you're saying, instead of just saying, here's the list of everything we need to know, I'm going to cram this down your throat.
Exactly.
You're saying, let's make it fun. Like, let's build this all into something you do care about, which might be baseball, might be dinosaurs.
Exactly. Whatever it is. Let's use that topic. Exactly. Mer people. Great example.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, for our school specifically, we try to tie it to content that's actually going to make a difference in solving a community problem.
Interesting.
So there's sort of a service learning aspect to every project that we do.
Yeah.
So if they're going to do recycling, you know, they're going to actually come up with some sort of sustainable recycling project as their final outcome to their unit. And they're going to learn ratios and proportions, and they're going to do fractions and decimals, and they're going to look at history of recycling over time in different areas geographically, and they're going to do persuasive text because they're going to be convincing different people to different audiences to use their recycling program. So everything, they're still going to learn the same common core, right? The same standards that they have to learn.
It's almost sneaky though.
Exactly. It's just, and to kids, you know, when you tell them, hey, would you rather sit down and, you know, memorize different types of, you know, persuasive text or how to do ratios and proportions, or would you rather solve this community problem of coming up with a way to recycle in our school, every single kid's going to choose the project.
Yeah, I mean,
because that's so much more exciting than let me memorize a bunch of information. So that's the school. That's the bulk of it. It's really that simple.
Okay, so you've built a whole school around this, and we'll talk about it. How did you get to there from you're a data scientist?
Oh, yeah. Taking a step back.
We skipped some steps.
Yeah, sorry.
No, you're fine.
So yeah, I was a data coach, and then I got enticed to leave a district school, actually. So I'd always, up to this point, worked in district schools. Kind of had a bad taste in my mouth for charters, too.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a big...
A lot of public school teachers kind of have...
It is, and it's all rumor, and most of it's rumor and reputation.
It feels almost like a religious debate
when you talk
to people. Like,
yeah,
like,
and honestly, I didn't even know what argument I was fighting. I just knew that all my teacher friends didn't like charters, so therefore I didn't like charters. But I didn't really even know what that meant. So I was invited to come be a part of a turnaround team for a failing charter school as their data coach. And, you know, I was told that the teachers had no idea how to even use data. I went and observed the teachers. It was probably some of the, I mean... Teachers are amazing, don't get me wrong, but there are some people who have teaching credentials who really should just not be teaching.
Interesting.
Not
because of their inability to do things with data.
No, just because they should not be teaching.
Right.
They're just in the wrong career.
Got it.
That's true in every career. Right, exactly. There's always people that you're like, how did you get into this? This is not the right fit for you. So I saw some really interesting classrooms in the school and a huge need for help.
Right.
I mean, they clearly had... They had no idea what they were doing instructionally, let alone data. I mean, they didn't know what student achievement data was, let alone what to do with it.
Wow.
So I joined that team to help turn around that failing school. We turned it around, and it took about a year and a half, completely new staff, new policies, procedures, curriculum, everything. And that became, we reopened it as the first public girls' school in Arizona.
Oh, interesting.
So that was sort of my first step into charter leadership.
You're kind of building a school, basically.
Mm-hmm. It was. It was basically getting rid of the old one and completely making a new one.
Wow.
So that was kind of what... got me thinking, okay, now I really want to do this, like, for real on my own and maybe bring the STEM in that I know we really need.
Because you had STEM still floating around.
I still had STEM floating around.
Ever since NASA and nanotech.
And so I definitely knew I wanted to come back to that. It was just a matter of how do I do that. And the only other school that I knew of who had opened, kind of just somebody saying, hey, I want to do this. I want to open a school is Phoenix Collegiate Academy.
Uh-huh.
And so Rachel Yanoff and Akshay Patel, who Akshay and I actually did our TFA teaching together. He helped me buy my first car. We go way back. So he and Rachel, when they opened that, they were sort of like the, you know, everybody worshiped them of like, oh my gosh, they opened their own school. That's crazy. They did it. But nobody else wanted to go down that road because it was scary and it was expensive. And really there wasn't a path to do it. You know, it was kind of like, holy cow, can you believe they did that? And
when was
wouldn't
this?
It be what amazing? Year? Gosh, I'm trying to think when they opened. I think they opened in like 2008 or 2009. They just had their second group of graduating seniors. So I was opening up the Girls Leadership Academy in 2010 and 2011.
Okay.
So a few
years
ago.
So they were right before you.
Yeah, right before they opened it, and we were like, oh, that's amazing.
Now, before that, let's talk a little bit about Arizona, because this is, Arizona has this unique statistic.
Mm-hmm.
20% of publicly funded education, like, so 20% of the kids in Arizona attend a charter school.
Mm-hmm.
That's more by double than any other
than
state.
Any other state. Yeah.
So Arizona is kind of charter central.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we're right here in the middle of it. But when you say nobody did it, the ones who did it were different. These were big organizations.
Big organizations that came in, people who had years and years of experience in education. I think what was really unique about Rachel and Akshay is they were, you know, they taught the same year I taught. You know, they maybe...
These are young,
they were
passionate
young,
people.
Passionate people who were just like, we're going to open a school. We don't like these options that our students in South Phoenix have, so we're going to do something better. And they did it.
And Rachel and Akshay, if you're listening, you guys are going to get hit for an interview request. So I'll definitely be wanting to get this story because I've talked to both of them. Really, truly amazing people. It makes you just feel like you meet people, and Angelica, you're in this group that like are involved on the ground with educating kids. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, we're in downtown Phoenix right now. These guys, Akshay is in South Phoenix. Mm-hmm. I mean, so these are kids that need it.
Yep.
And you think there's people that care, like really putting their mm-hmm. tears and blood and sweat into this.
Literally.
It gives you like good feelings. It's like, okay, the world's going to be all right.
Right.
You know, I mean, we need more of these people, but like at least some of this is happening. And
it is. Yeah, it is. And then one thing that was really unique from that point, and this is where Andrew Collins comes back in, is he was part of this Aspiring Leaders Fellowship. And I'm pretty sure he was part of spearheading it through the Charter School Association.
Right.
And so I found out about that opportunity, and all of a sudden there was a path to open a school.
Right.
So it was like, the seas parted, and I was like, oh my gosh, I could actually do this. There's
because
a way to do this.
That program was for people like you, somebody passionate without maybe the ways and means to create anew. Their whole objective was we want more charter schools to exist, specifically serving underprivileged kids.
Exactly.
So you go for that program.
So I went for that program, got into that program, spent time traveling the country looking at really good schools, applied for a big bunch of grant money from the federal government, got that, which allowed us to look at even more schools, spent a lot of time out at High Tech High in San Diego, built most of our model out of what they're doing out there.
Yeah.
And in that process, so I left Girls Leadership knowing, okay, I'm going to open my own school, but I wasn't quite ready. I had to go through this program and everything. And at the same time, there was another school that was opening that fall. And so I called the school director, Brian Holman, over at Empower College Prep, and I said, let me come help you open your school. And he's like, great, I need a business and operations person.
Okay.
I said, awesome, I will learn everything I need to know about school business and operations, and I will help you open your school, and then I'll go open mine. And it was a win-win situation.
Wow.
He's like, great, you come help me open mine. I know you're going to do a good job because you need to learn it for your own school. And then we'll have nice policies and procedures in place, and you can go open your own school, and I'll be established. So
in this charter, this world of charter schools, do you don't look at it as competitive? I mean, potentially somebody that he could be thinking, I'm training the replacement for my, or like a competitor.
Sure. I mean, we had conversations around location. I think that's the biggest challenge, right? Of like, don't set up shop right next door to me.
Right.
You know, but the other thing about charter schools is it's all about fit. Right?
I
mean, the thing that's so unique and that I love as a parent of charter schools, of kids in charter schools, is that it's about finding the right fit for your kid. And I mean, I've got four kids, and they're all in different schools.
All four.
One's little. She's still in daycare, but you know, they're all going to go. They're going to continue going to different schools, and we talk at home all the time about, well, what's the right school for this one, and what's the right school for that one, because they all have different interests, they all have different passions, and they all have different ways of learning. And so, what's really unique about charter schools is we're able to differentiate that way. So you can have, you know, Empower College Prep is an amazing college prep school. It has a very specific way of teaching kids. PCA, same thing. Really great college prep school, different way of teaching kids.
Right.
System, college prep school, different way of teaching kids. So there's all these.
That's her own school she's talking about. System is the name of the school that we are in right now.
Yes. So
you don't feel like everyone has to come to system.
No, absolutely not.
And it doesn't hurt your feelings
not.
If someone chooses
not
to.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, sometimes I've had kids where I've referred them. They've come in and said, oh, my kid's so into the arts. This is what they want to do. And I'm like, well, let me show you some great art schools.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a balance because, of course, we want our enrollment goals to be met every year, right? But I never want to push a family to come to system if their kid is not a project-based learning type of learner, or they're not really into STEM and they want to do performing arts. I mean, that's great, but we have very little performing arts here. We have a strengths program, which is awesome, but we don't have dance or ballet or chorus or any of the other performing arts. So
I laugh because you and I have talked in the past about your football team here.
Yes,
I know they're going strong.
They're trying.
It reminds me of. So I had gone to a big undergraduate institution where football was like a big deal. Mm-hmm. And then I went to MIT for grad school, which is, as most people know, it's all about STEM. It's all about tech. And I was studying physics. And I go and I walked by. The football team was practicing on the practice field. MIT has a football team.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were talking about your football team here, it reminded me, because these were guys that looked like kind of the same size and talent of my high school football team that I had gone to. So I was like, well, I never played football in high school. But, you know, I've, like, grown, and I probably still
maybe I
have,
can play.
I still have my eligibility, you know. I was thinking about going out for the MIT football team. I decided not to, but
it is. I mean, we try to have sports to a certain extent because that's
you want it well-rounded.
Yeah, you want it well-rounded, but at the same time, we can't be everything to everyone.
Sure.
That's not the purpose of us, right? Because then we just become the same as a giant district high school,
right?
Which is, I have to meet the needs of every student in our community.
Sounds exhausting.
It is. I mean, that's why you have to have 3,000 kids in it,
right?
And then you end up with these giant schools that don't have that small school feel and that culture, and you get away from what you're really intending to do in the beginning. So
it's very interesting.
So we chose to keep it small and specialize in STEM. So, you know, it's in our name, it's in our mission, it's what we tell every family who walks in our door.
System.
Exactly.
It's
putting STEM back in the educational system.
Literally.
So, yeah. Exactly.
Well, let's talk about your projects and tell me a little bit about STEM. So you opened the school through the help of that grant program.
Yep.
And you've done High Tech High is kind of become a famous school. They're in San Diego.
Oh, yeah.
They're all about, they've pioneered this idea of project-based learning. So talk about your, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but there's a documentary film that
Most
Likely to Succeed, all about their school.
Yes.
And I remember somebody that I trust came to me and said, you got it, we're doing a screening of this documentary, you got to come check it out. And it was interesting because you saw these kids kind of grappling with building projects and incorporating everything they've learned into a project. So tell me about kind of how your visit sort of shaped your view and what you've put together here.
Yeah. So our first visit out there, we've been out there a few times, but our first visit out there, we spent a lot of time in classrooms and observing and seeing what kids were doing and talking to teachers. And that, I think, was the most meaningful part of our visit. I mean, we went through the traditional, let's read all the theory of why this works and how you do it. But seeing it in action, I think for us, was what really made it real and just gives you a vision of what it's supposed to look like. And so then we took that vision and we came back and said, okay, how do we make that work in our community? What's going to be different? What's going to be the same? And that became the writing of the charter, you know, which is this 500-page application to the State Board of Charter Schools where you spell out every single thing you're going to do. What are your courses going to look like? All the business side of it. What's your budget? What's your business plan? How are you going to market? what are you going to do when kids fail? How are you going to retain them? I mean, anything you can think of that a school has to figure out, was in that charter special application.
It's all special English language learners. Yeah. So if anyone's interested in this, I know Angelica is making a strong case here. These are all publicly available. You can find the 500-page document to which we are referring.
You want some light reading on
a
weekend?
Go read it. Yeah, it is interesting. There's some, but it's cool because you do get to look at, there's the section that talks about kind of educational philosophy and mission. Mm-hmm. So it really asks people to spell that out. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, lots and lots and lots of detail.
Exactly.
Which I'm sure some of it has changed, right? Because
oh my gosh, so much. That I think is, gosh, in hindsight, if I could give advice to anybody who wants to do this, is just be ready for that. Right. Everything changes.
You still have to write the 500 pages.
But don't be surprised if 3 years later, only 200 pages are, exactly the way you pictured them being.
That'd be good, I think.
So, everything changes. I mean, you realize, that the way you wanted to staff isn't going to work with what's available in the teacher market. So you make adjustments. We have this massive teacher shortage in Arizona. So, all of a sudden you wanted teachers that were dual qualified in 3 or 4 subjects. And that's like an impossible needle in a haystack. So you modify, and all of a sudden, you're contracting for some of your teaching positions. And you adjust. So
that's awesome. I mean, yeah, it sounds really interesting that, that you guys have put this whole school together, you've built this out. So let's do talk about projects. Tell me kind of maybe we go through it as like a day in the life of a ninth grader.
Yeah, here at System, what it looks like. That's a great question. So there's something that we've changed a little bit. We set it up one way in the beginning, and then we realized that academically, because our students were kind of across the board, we had really high achieving students, and then we also had some really low achieving students, and then we had some in the middle. But the two ends of the spectrum are much higher here than I'd say in other schools. So we have a lot of really high achieving, gifted students who have just not had the opportunity to be pushed, and they're like, naturally, I'm into STEM, this is what I want to do. Right. They have a path, they figured it out. So we have a bunch of those kids, and then we have the other end of kids who've been in traditional schools, who've been trying to memorize information for 5 years, and clearly it's not working, and now they're several years behind. So we took a look at our student body, and we kind of shifted our schedule around. So now what it looks like, it was a bit more integrated, and kids kind of had these large 2-hour block integrated classes, but we realized quickly that when students are all over the board, they needed a little bit more structure in that. How do I learn what I need to learn? So we've gone back to, or not back to, but we've moved on to a bit of a different schedule. So if I'm a typical, let's just say, eighth grader, and I come in, the first class I go to, it's called my advocacy class, and it's not a homeroom. I always stay away from homeroom. My homeroom is just check off your homework and take attendance and you're done. But it's not a homeroom. It's meant to be like an advisory period. So this is a group where you've got a teacher and maybe 15 kids, and it's a time where students can connect with their advocate, who is really supposed to be their person.
And what do you mean an advocate?
Like, it's a teacher. It's a teacher at the school, and it should be the same teacher from the time they enter to the time they graduate.
Okay.
So this person gets to know them. They become their, person that they go to for everything. The advocate should know their goals, their dreams, their aspirations, what challenges they have at home, what challenges they have in school, with peers, in the classroom, anything.
Yeah.
Anything that they should know about that student as a whole student, to really know the kid and what they need and what sort of support they need to be successful, that's what the advocate's in charge of doing.
So on the one hand, this is scaring me, because it's like, you don't learn any of that in like teaching school, right? Mm-hmm. Like how to be...
No, you don't.
So, I mean, and that's, you could argue like there's all these like technical credentials that maybe should go into it. On the other hand, I'm kind of like, maybe it's fine, because as long as they care about the kid.
Yeah, it's a mentor is what it is. You basically becoming a mentor. And we do training in the summertime to prepare teachers. So they know, like, okay, how do you lead, a circle? How do you, get kids working on dream folders or things like that?
Does it work?
That.
I mean, are they?
It is, yeah. It's exciting, because it contributes to this really close-knit culture on campus. So we always tell every parent who comes in, because we're so small, every teacher knows every kid and every kid knows every teacher. But it's not that they just know their names. Right. It's like, I could pull any teacher in here right now and I could say, tell me about, I'll use a fake name, but tell me about Maria, right? Or Mary. And they can tell me, oh, she's got this many brothers and sisters. She lives with her mom here. Her favorite things to do are this. She really wants to be this when she grows up, but she's also considering this. So they intimately definitely know their students to a level that usually you don't get to do when you've got 150 kids cycling through your class and you just don't have time to do that.
So they have time. You built a structure.
So we built that structure into the schedule.
But also you've tried to find the type of people that would care.
Right, that would care.
It's possible to be here and not care.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, and we've had teachers come through the door who are no longer here for reasons like that. But we specifically look for teachers that show that passion, that caring.
Interesting.
And that, you know, desire to go above. You know, we want a teacher that's like, you know, they're thinking more about just what are your test scores, or, you know, did you do your homework, or let me check off all the things I can in red pen that you haven't done for me. You know, we're always looking for teachers that are above and beyond.
Awesome.
So we build that structure into the day. So they go to their advocacy class, and then they go to their core classes. So they'll go to a math class, a science class, an English language arts class, and a social studies class. If they're higher achieving, they'll go to a project-based learning class. If they're lower achieving, they'll go to an intervention class and a project-based learning class. So it kind of depends on the levels of students.
Got it.
And so we don't set up our classes like you're an eighth grader, you're a seventh grader. They all have their grades, but they're mixed in the middle school based on math abilities. So we've got a group that might be a higher achieving math group that's getting pushed, and then we have another group that's kind of the middle.
Like we've got algebra down.
Exactly.
Now
we're ready to do higher level math. Yeah. And then we've got kids that are struggling with math, and so they're getting remediation in their math.
And both of those through projects?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
All of that happens through
the choice of the project.
It's just the choice of the project and what specific standards they're working on, you know, and then that way teachers know, okay, this cohort of kids, you know, they're ready for these math standards. And so I'm going to make sure that whatever project they're doing, they're working on these math standards because I know they're ready for it.
So I just keep hearing like the word personalized, like keeps showing up because you've already like carved out a niche that's pretty specific, the type of people that are going to come here.
Mm-hmm.
But even within that, it's like we've got the kind of different cohorts, different levels of standards. So you're personalizing, you know, every aspect of this. Plus, it's literally personal because you've got each kid knowing their advocate and interacting that way. So how have you found that to be, you know, like helpful with these kids? I mean, do they seem engaged, like more so than maybe go back to your kindergartners when you first started teaching?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, maybe not kindergarten because kindergarten is the best grade to teach.
They're all engaged.
They just love everything.
They start out engaged.
They start off very engaged. But, you know, it's something I noticed as I taught older grades is they lost that love for learning.
Yeah.
Right? Every kindergartner comes in and you're like, we're going to learn that letter A today. And they're like, yeah, that's awesome. And you're like, yeah, that's awesome. And they're like, you're the best. We love you. And you're like, I love you too.
Give me a hug.
Everybody, the hugs and boogers are everywhere, right? But then you move into, you know, and I noticed this when I moved to fifth grade, and I think it was also the cohort of kids that I was working with in fifth grade. It was right when Arizona passed this law with English language learners where they said everybody has to take this English language test, and anybody who doesn't pass it has to be separated and go to a different class. And it was before they'd realized, okay, a lot of students who have special needs are not able to pass this test. So I literally had a class of 35 kids, and 17 of them had IEPs, which is the Individualized Education Plan, another acronym, which means they were getting special education. So I had a cohort of kids that had significant needs and had failed for year after year after year in the traditional system. So when I got to fifth grade, I realized with this group of kids that I had, most of them were checked out. They were like, I'm so used to failing. I failed every other year. Why would I try? Yeah. And so I saw that stark difference between kindergarten, right, that passion and love for learning, and then fifth grade of, well, I failed my whole education for the past 5 years, and now, you know, I'm 12 years old, and I know I'm just going to keep failing, so my interest in education is pretty much non-existent. So, you know, minus two or three kids in the class, everybody didn't want to be there.
That was the attitude.
That was the attitude, yeah.
And now you're trying to do something to them that they do not
exactly
want.
And they're like, I don't want to just memorize more of this.
Right.
So, you know, I think transitioning up to that older grade level and then working with those students who were also new to the country and barely spoke English, and seeing their frustration and noticing how passive kids had gotten of just give me the information. I'll just sit here and you just fill my brain. And that was their concept of what school was.
Yeah.
Was I'll sit here, you talk, I'll take notes, you tell me what multiple choice questions to do, and I'll sit here and do them in the textbook. And we're basically blowing that completely up at our school. It's the complete opposite of that. So there's no lecture, like, ever. I mean, I'd say there's, like, mini lessons here and there where a teacher will say, okay, you guys, you know, for this project, you need work on ratios, so I'm going to give you this little mini lesson on how this works. Now go forth and practice it. But for the most part, there's no kids taking notes and memorizing information like you would find in a traditional school. So
they're not taking notes anyway.
Well, yeah, exactly. Normally, in a, right, they're just copying in traditional classrooms. So yeah, it turns it upside down. And so now they're working on these projects where they are learning all of these standards through the projects that they're doing, right. And it's much more student-driven.
You give, like, an example? I think it would help to see, like, an example of a project.
So let's do the recycling one. This is, like, always the one I go back to for parents when they're kind of trying to see what does that look like.
Right.
So let's say we have this big driving question of how do we create a sustainable recycling program for a school?
Okay.
So with PBL, you always have to figure out who your audience is, right?
Project-based
learning. Are you trying to solve, like, the whole world's problem of recycling? Are you just trying to solve recycling in Arizona or just in Phoenix or just in our school, right? You have to figure out
So you create a scope.
Yeah, you create your scope, right? So you have, okay, we're going to solve this recycling problem here at our school because we have so much waste. Kids are throwing stuff away constantly. Mm-hmm. How do we create a program that's actually going to have an impact and be sustainable? And so that becomes your driving question.
Yeah.
So you take that driving question and then you figure out, okay, what do we already know? You know, maybe we already know how much recycling is getting wasted. Maybe we already know that the community is not recycling because they're just throwing stuff everywhere. Or maybe they are recycling some things like paper, but maybe nothing else. So they sort of do this analysis of what do we know, what do we need to know, and then how are we going to go and find that information? So that's sort of their preliminary part of planning the project.
Right.
Just like in the workplace,
that's
right? Have a problem, you
it's
have
like,
to solve.
This information.
Exactly. Yeah. What do we know? What do we not know? Where are we going
to
find it?
To this point so far, I'll just say from an observer, from the outsider, it's like, I'm interested, and I have no idea what I'm actually, like what the standards even would be that I'm going to be learning, which is great, probably.
Yeah.
It's like hidden.
Exactly, it's hidden,
like,
I'm
doing this cool project.
Kids aren't like, oh, I need to know ratios.
And
like,
it's valuable
they don't even know they need
to the school.
Ratios.
It's like, we've got this issue, or we're just wasting too much, so we need
so we need a solution for it. Yeah, so then they go forth and sort of make a project proposal of how are they going to go about solving this problem,
right.
And what do they need to know? That need to know basically becomes what are the standards, and that's where the teacher intervenes a lot with, you know, okay, well, if you're trying to create a sustainable recycling program, you're going to need to know, like, what in the community, not just beyond our school, what gets wasted. So maybe you need to talk to the city of Phoenix and you need to find out, you know, how much recycling gets dumped. And maybe you need some statistics on that.
Right.
And then you need to find out why it gets dumped. And then you're going to have to do some sort of a comparison to how much they're actually picking up and how much they're dumping. And so that's actually called a ratio. And so you're going to need to know. Exactly. You're going to need to know you're going to need to know decimals here, fractions, percentages, ratios. And so that's when the teacher gives a little more guidance. And here's some math you're going to need to learn.
And then it becomes cross curriculum, right? So like you're writing as part of that.
Yeah. So then with the writing, right? So let's say closer to towards the end of the project, it's okay. Well, now you have your plan figured out. Now how are you going to convince people to do it? Well, this is a great opportunity to learn persuasive text.
Right.
So now you actually have to persuade. So how do you persuade somebody to do something? Well, let's look up all the different ways that you can persuade. Right. There's all these text strategies, right, in the English language arts that we say are ways you can persuade people to do things in your writing. And so let's look at those and let's work those into your proposal. So then when you, you know, put it out to the community, you have some kind of
a Facebook
hope
post
that,
that's like, you
yeah, that people are going to convince.
Yeah.
Yeah, that people are going to be convinced that your program is going to work.
Got it.
So,
amazing.
So yeah, it all integrates.
So they
every
do
subject.
Everything. They learn a little bit of science.
They learn a little bit of each. Yeah. And so teachers collaborate more than in any other school, probably, because they have to, because the science teacher has to be talking to the math teacher, has to be talking to the English teacher, so that they know, oh, we're working on the recycling unit, and they need persuasive text in this project, so can you support them with that?
Right.
So that way the English teacher knows, oh, yeah, the whole group of kids, they need a little mini lesson on persuasive text, so I'm going to get them some resources for that.
Interesting.
So it's differentiated and personalized, and yet still very rigorous, right, because kids are expected to do very challenging work in the process of this.
So fascinating. And I can totally see how engagement would be really high. Mm-hmm. You'd feel kids
high.
Coming, wanting to be here. Mm-hmm. I bet your sick days are lower even. I mean, I don't know if you track that.
Yeah. I think our teachers work really, really hard. I think sick days for students are definitely low.
Well, that's what I meant.
I thought you meant for teachers.
Maybe
okay.
Teachers,
our teachers,
yeah.
They need
a break. Yeah.
They need fall break. But yeah, our sick days for students actually are very low. We were just looking at our attendance data for this past, the first quarter, right? The first 2 months of school. And noticing, we have a small population. We only have 115 kids. But even just this year, we've had literally two or three kids absent each day in the whole school,
yeah,
which is really, really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And higher than we've ever had in years past, too.
Right.
And that's because we've put a lot of focus this year into making sure that that academic program is really, really strong.
Right.
So that project-based learning focus is, we're more true to our mission this year than we ever have been.
And you're part of a team when you're doing mm-hmm. these projects. So it's like there's this accountability factor too.
Yep, exactly.
Like, well, I don't want to let down my.
Oh yeah.
Maybe, or maybe you just want to coast.
Oh no, there's definitely an accountability. And kids get graded, they get grades for their portion,
yeah,
but they also get graded on those 21st century skills.
Right.
So it's not just did you learn your math, did you learn your science, but we actually have a school-wide goal, and students are aware of this goal. We say it every morning at our Monday morning meeting with our whole school assembly. We have a goal that 80% of our students will be proficient in the 21st century skills. So that means that they've got to be proficient in communication, collaboration, critical thinking, that we're actually grading them on this. We're doing
yeah.
those rubrics every week, which most schools, if it's not a state
yeah.
standard, we don't grade
it's
it.
Not on easy
right?
merit.
It's not on easy merit. We don't grade it. Exactly.
Right. Interesting.
So we actually have a school-wide goal, and it's just as important to us as easy merit is.
Right.
Because ultimately, that's great if a kid can pass AZ Merit, but if they can't work in a team and they can't collaborate and they can't communicate, yeah, they're not going to get a job. They're
yeah.
not going to be successful in college. So,
jeez, that's amazing. It seems so obvious, but yeah.
It does, but it's sad that most schools aren't
not
doing
it,
again, because it's not where the money trail is. So.
Money, follow the money.
Yep.
So you said the word assessment and grades, mm-hmm. and I know we're basically out of time, but let's just talk about that
yeah.
a little bit, because I could imagine somebody who's been in a traditional classroom
yeah.
who's used to I give you the worksheet or the test,
yep.
you fill out your answers, and then I give you a percentage of
yeah.
what you understand and what you don't. But you do a project, it's a little different, right?
It is very different, and we do standards-based grading too, which is
okay.
a whole other field of something to research on education. But so standards-based grading is all about basically how well do you know one specific standard. So let's go back to the recycling. So if it's ratios, if I have evidence through your project that you have mastered ratios to this level of rigor, you get a one, a two, or three, or a four.
Yeah.
Four is this backwards and forwards. You could teach it to somebody else. Three is, okay, you have a solid understanding of ratios because I can see you've applied it in all these different ways throughout
right.
the project. So that's how kids are graded. So it's not percentage. It's not how much homework did you turn in. It's not how much did you participate. It's
and
not,
the teacher has to go through this, go
mm-hmm.
through the project. They sit down with a team of three kids or
mm-hmm.
something.
Yeah. So kids do presentations every Friday.
Okay.
And they're not done every Friday. It's not like every project is a week.
Right.
Some projects take 3 or 4 or 5 weeks.
Right.
Usually somewhere between 4 to 6 weeks for most projects. But every Friday they present where they're at.
Okay.
So one Friday they might be presenting their proposal because they're right at the beginning stage. The next Friday they might be presenting for a peer review and getting feedback on what they've done so far.
Right.
The third Friday then they might be doing another peer review and getting feedback on an update. And then maybe the next one they're doing their final presentation where they're getting that final grade.
So the peers are sitting there watching,
mm-hmm.
evaluating them on those standards, or that's all done just the teacher does the standards based?
Peers, the teacher does the standards-based, the peers do the 21st century skills.
Okay, so you're these people are not
so you're how well did they collaborate? How well are they communicating? Are
right.
they even able to tell us what their project is supposed to be telling us?
And you actually use that data. It's
mm-hmm.
this is part of your grade.
Yep, peers turn their rubrics into the PBL teacher, and then the PBL teacher selects all of that together.
Puts it all together.
Mm-hmm, to make the grade.
Wow, so a
yeah.
lot of... I mean, sounds more like how I'd be evaluated at a job
mm-hmm.
in the technology industry or probably anywhere else, right?
Yep.
Any sort of modern economy job.
Exactly.
You're sort of like, I did this thing.
Yeah.
We worked with this team. Here's what the team thought. Here's what the boss thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Here's the kind of hard evidence that it worked.
Exactly.
It's great.
Yep.
Angelica, this is so helpful. So good. As we're tying this up, maybe just kind of make your case for project-based learning, and what would you love to see happening, you know, in other kind of education settings? Obviously, it's not, you said there's differences, and it's not maybe for everybody.
True.
But can you make the case, and then we'll...
Yeah, I would say the bigger vision of STEM in particular is that we'll have great STEM schools all over the country. And it's one of the reasons we named our school STEM Phoenix, right? Because we want to have STEM Glendale, STEM LA, STEM New York, STEM Portland.
I mean, Mesa.
There we go. Right. STEM Mesa. We actually have a high demand for like Laveen and Surprise, and then Mesa and Scottsdale. Those are like those four corners are kind of what people keep saying, when are you going to open a new campus there? So that's definitely the bigger picture, is that we'll have these project-based learning STEM schools all over the country.
Yeah.
Because right now, they're few and far between. I'd say, you know, 95% of the schools in the country are not project-based learning.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, STEM may not be for everybody. Some kids might be into arts and, you know, some kids might be into sports. There might be other things that kids are passionate about. But STEM is more about being a project-based learning school, and STEM is our vehicle to get there, but project-based learning is what we're really doing that's different, and that's what we'd like to see in more schools.
Just get this out there. Just get kids working on projects.
Get kids working on projects, because that's what they're going to need to do when they get out in the workforce. They've got to work in teams. They've got to solve problems. It's the only thing that's going to make a difference in our world right now. If everybody sits in a cubicle and just takes multiple choice tests, it's not going to change anything.
Even if they get perfect scores.
Even if they get perfect scores, exactly. If they can't work in a team and they can't collaborate, we're not going to have progress.
That's great. Angelica Cruz, thank you so much for sitting here and talking to me. And good luck with STEM Phoenix and all the other systems that we hope to see.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Prenda Podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or innovating in education. And if you want to follow my progress designing a new model for school, you can learn more at school.prenda.co.